Voices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for informational and educational purposes only.
Better, stronger, faster. A man barely alive, faster. Better, stronger, faster. Steve Austin, faster. Be that man.
Better than he was before.
Back to Muscle Mind with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I am Scott McNally. This program is brought to you by True Nutrition. Our codes are Advices, and you can get 25% off of their oatmeal blends with the code Advices Oats. I've been really dosing up on that beta alanine, Scott. I got up to like three servings, and my skin's all like burning and itching, and I'm like, oh, I'm getting crazy pumped. But
50 grams a day.
Not quite that high yet. But what's up, man? How you doing?
Good. Hopefully we got fingers crossed. It's a rainy day today, and because my house is on the river, my best. Even though I've got brand new boxes, electrical boxes in my house, literally it's been done twice now. I still will lose power for like just everything will go out and comes right back on.
I thought you were going to say because your house is on the river, we were afraid you were going to get swept away.
No, I'm not even in a flood zone.
Okay. Hey, I got a question for you. Totally off topic. Have you ever thought about living on a houseboat? Have you ever considered that in a serious way? Because I can see you doing that.
I almost bought an island a couple of years ago.
Guys, doesn't surprise you. It does not surprise me.
There was land. It came up on Zillow. It literally is an island.
You're kidding.
Out in the Hillsborough River. But it's just it could have been fixed up. It was for sale for like $20,000, something like that. It's a pretty large parcel of land.
Wow.
Most, which would be partially submerged depending on, you know, the rainy season, what have you. But it would just have been like, there's gators out there.
Ooh.
Yeah, you can see gator. Like, you can go to the park down the road from my house, and there's gators. You can literally go.
Suki wouldn't be allowed to just run around and do what she wanted.
No. Well, they all stay away from that stuff. There was probably a water moccasin. There was a snake. Looked like a rattler, but I think it was probably a water moccasin in my driveway.
No kidding. Those are poisonous, too, aren't they?
Yeah. It was a viper.
Oh geez.
It was like the whole thing, man. Yeah, they, I saw it. I walked outside and it went, I thought, one direction.
Yeah.
And I went to get something to try to like take it out, because it's just like, that's right where I walk out with the dogs, the dog walk. It's just, I don't want to kill stuff, but kill or be killed, almost literally.
Yeah.
Because I've been through rattlesnake bites three times now.
You've been bit, or your dogs had been bit?
I have been through the experience with my dogs being bit.
Oh, geez. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Well, I had my dogs on antivenin for rattlesnake bites, which actually works.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. It's not cool. Yeah. It just melts. There's all sorts of proteolytic substances in there and toxins. It literally just melts tissue.
That's what I've heard. I mean, I've watched enough Lifetime or Discovery Channel TV shows.
Just awful. Yeah. Rusty, and the dog who I dedicated the book there behind you on the shelf to.
Yes.
He got hit twice by a rattlesnake.
You're kidding.
It was right outside. Yeah. Wow. And it was actually created issues. He got hit on his inner thigh. He ran into like this little kind of cul-de-sac of cacti where they had been seeing little rodents. I'm not sure if it was a mice or a ground squirrel, probably ground squirrels, who knows, for days. And of course, the snake knew that it was there too.
Yeah.
So we come out and they run right over to where they've been seeing the rodents, and the snake was there. And Rusty literally ran into this like cul-de-sac. There's nothing but cacti behind him and the snake in front of him. He's got no place to go. So I think he just kind of like jumped and the snake hit him twice.
Mm.
On his inner thigh, and that skin, I had to have surgery on him like 2-3 years later. It never healed really properly. It was just terrible.
Well, let's jump into some bodybuilding here. I know you have a topic that you want to talk about. Before you do, though, I wanted to tell you, I don't know if you saw on social media this weekend, I got to train with somebody that you work with, Kate DeNunzio. She was out here with Matt Marshall, who I work with. He was competing at Central States.
So we got a push workout in. It was mostly just chest and shoulders. We didn't do triceps. And then the following day, they trained back. I trained by them. And then the day after that, we trained legs together yesterday. So we got to hang out with Kate.
I literally she just did a check-in this morning, and she said you're at the powerhouse, right?
Detroit? Yes, yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, I'm like, Shelby trains there sometimes, and Scott used to go and train there a lot, and she didn't mention it in her check-in. She mentioned all the other people.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Yeah, she mentioned other people, but she didn't mention you. I'm like, okay, so funny.
Yeah. It was good. I never got a chance to train with Matt Marshall, and we've worked together for a few years, and he just competed the day before, but it was one of those things I felt like, let's really do this, because this is an opportunity to kind of show him, like, he needs to grow his legs this next off season. And it's like, well, this is our one opportunity we have to, like, let's make sure that you really know how to push the intensity. So we did. And he hung in there. He's pretty sore today. He gained a bunch of water overnight too, which I'm guessing, I mean, he didn't go crazy with the food. We didn't do any kind of crazy water manipulation. I'm guessing a big part of that though was the inflammation, because we went pretty hard yesterday.
Yeah, be careful. I would get him on some anti-inflammatories. That's the rhabdo type of
type of
response. Like, literally, he could be totally fucked up.
We're watching him. We're watching him on this one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how much water did he gain?
He gained about, it was like 11 pounds. But I mean, he also had really carved up, you know.
Be careful.
Yeah. We're watching it. But I wanted to mention that briefly though. We got a chance to train. So what was your topic?
All right. So here's the thing there's multiple topics that I think I can kind of merge into what I hope will be somewhat of an educational experience for the listeners. And sometimes I make the mistake of directing my information towards sometimes sort of the higher echelon of understanding to try to bring people up.
Yeah.
So I overspeak shit. I use too much scientific, you know, terminology, blah, 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 blah. People, I've heard several times in the last couple of months, people would mention me on another podcast, not this one or any of yours even, and say, I don't know what the hell Stevenson has to say. I have to, like, he's obviously really smart, but I can't tell what the fuck he's talking about. So,
that's not what you want, obviously.
It's a joke, really. Yeah, it's just, I think it's kind of a lame excuse, to be honest. It's like, you know, if you think it's interesting and worthwhile, then fucking press pause and Google. And that's kind of where I'm going at with this. So, on one of the boards, there was a post that was started. I'm not going to mention exactly where I found, but it was a link to a Washington – it was a thread that was started. It was linked to a Washington Post article. So we get in the news and its interpretation of science. And the title of the article is Need to Recover After a Workout? Eat a Cheeseburger.
I like that.
Yeah. So then the first line is McDonald's must be loving it. You can find this in the Washington Post. It was dated. Where's the date? Actually, it's an old one. So this is all old. Oh, that's fine. It's not a problem. This is a study I hadn't seen before.
Okay.
So this was for some reason this got dredged up, but it's a really interesting insight into how the news will sort of derange scientific information in order to get people's attention, because all they're doing is selling clicks and views and reading so they can obviously sell their ads, et cetera. Picture of a kid here eating what looks to be like a McDonald's cheeseburger.
Yeah, post-workout, post-leg day.
Yeah, and it's studied, and it says, a study has found that fast food is just as effective as expensive energy bars, protein drinks, or dietary supplements when it comes to recovering from intense workouts. Junk food may be just as good as those high-tech powders, gummies, and shakes in your gym bag. So that's the opening line. If you click on where it says study, which normally you think would link you to the actual study,
right,
it links you to another article where they ported in the information.
Okay.
And then, which doesn't show the study, and that's a new study, however, and you click on that, you can eventually find the study. So the study is on... it's easy to find, actually. The link is on PubMed site, and the title of the study, this was published in 2015. Kramer is the first name with a C, C-A-C-R-A-M-E-R, is at University of Montana. Post-exercise glycogen recovery and exercise performance is not significantly different between fast food and sport supplements.
Hmm.
Okay, so now immediately I'm thinking to myself, So we take a normal, a typical fast food meal. And then if we're talking about sports supplements, we're talking about glycogen recovery. We're going to engineer the sports supplements that are being used to maximize glycogen recovery.
Sure.
So we would probably use like a highly branched cyclic dextrin. Creatine has been known to increase glycogen storage. Protein in combination with carbohydrates can do the same. We want a high glycemic index, easily absorbable. Basically using the whole friggin' premise of a sports supplement to maximize glycogen recovery, at least just reading there. So that's sort of what you'd expect. Is it kind of like how it jumps out at you too?
That's what it sounds like to me.
Talking about, you know, the high-tech powders, gummies, and shakes in your gym bag.
I wasn't sure about the gummies, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? Yeah, I guess I don't. They have to do something. Obviously, here I had someone that I kind of knew for a while who wrote for one of the Phoenix newspapers, and she was a science writer.
Okay.
And she had absolutely no scientific background. She was very bright.
Yeah.
But she had none. Her background was in journalism.
Okay.
Which was appropriate.
Yeah.
And she was sort of scientifically inclined. She was bright. But she was writing about all sorts of shit that she had no friggin' idea about. Mm. She'd never taken a molecular biology class, a genetics class. I don't even know that she had like a physics. She's writing about all like the hard sciences.
Wow.
And sort of the more difficult like biological sciences without any background. So
I would take for granted that if I were to read one of her articles, that the newspaper, you know, would have hired somebody who was a specialist in this department. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, maybe they have some writing experience. Obviously they do by the quality of their writing. But first and foremost, this person has a science background. So first of all, that's one thing that's kind of interesting right there.
Yeah. So I don't know if this person does or not. And a lot of times I think my guess is from just having this conversation with one person who's kind of an insider is that, you know, the high-tech powders, gummies, shakes in your gym bag, like,
yeah.
Maybe he thinks people have lots of gummies. Maybe he saw some guy with gummies the day before the gym.
Right.
I don't know. So,
or you go to a GNC, they have them at the counter. Like, here, try these. They'll have some. What do they call? It'll be like a glucosamine gummies. You know. They're only $13.99 a bottle. That's here's a
probably,
sample.
Yeah. Like the most expensive way to possibly get glucosamine.
To get a third of a dose or something.
So you know? I'm reading through this thread then.
Yeah.
And. There's a couple things that pop out, and why I'm bringing this up is I'm not going to say who the online names of these folks, but be careful if you're someone who sees this, you've got, first of all, filtered information through the reporter. If you read the article.
Sure.
And then there's another filter based on, and a lot of these people are vets on the site, and there's three pages so far on this particular thread. And from what I can tell, there's not a – and some of them are just – they're going off on tangents about how much they love burgers and what the best burgers are and this kind
naturally,
of stuff.
Naturally.
But that's totally cool. Like that's a discussion board. We're having fun. But there are some people that are really digging in and making strong opinionated criticisms of the science, of the findings, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
And as far as I can tell, I didn't read the study. So,
right.
So here's the things, like, for instance, that I found. Let's see, I made some notes here for this.
Uh-oh, Scott came prepared. Look out.
Oh, yeah. So one person said that this confirms something that this person's been saying about branched chain amino acids, hydro EAA mixes, a waste of money.
Mm.
So let's see. And then someone else says, the full article costs $25, so we cannot see who actually funded the research. Red flag. Well, I'll tell you what, if you click on the PubMed and then you go and try to, and then you click on where the full article is found, you would have to buy it if you went through the actual publication. However, this is super duper important for people because I just got asked this literally yesterday.
Okay.
Someone wanted the research or something. Scholar.google.com.
Mm-hmm.
Go to scholar.google.com. You paste in the title of that. We can maybe post this up at some point in time. The title of that study, you get it for free, the whole study. This actually was a sort of a pre-publication version of the study, but it's got all the data, everything's there.
Okay.
You can find those studies many, many, many times, more than 50% of the time.
Okay.
I would bet for free, and there's nothing illegal about whether those being put out, from as far as I understand. So
okay.
So let's see, EAAs and Hydro, like this sort of generic. So let's see what they actually tested. Like, it's sports supplements, right? You're thinking supplements that are, these are highly engineered. Absolutely. Well, they're fast food is, they don't say this, but my guess, they basically, here's what they did. And in the article that was first linked, they said that they did treadmill running. Well, they did, it wasn't a treadmill run. It was actually a cycling bout. Okay. They did a 90-minute cycling bout to reduce glycogen levels, gave them two meals at the 0 and 2 hour point after that 90-minute cycling bout.
Okay.
And then they did a 20-kilometer time trial on a cycle. So these were cyclists, trained cyclists.
Okay.
That's a very, very typical way of evaluating performance. So basically, they put them in a potential situation where they're lacking in glycogen, and glycogen become a limiting factor for performance on that 20-kilometer time trial. Hmm. So basically, cycle 20 kilometers as fast as you friggin' can. And then they gave them two different types of meals that would replenish glycogen to see if one is maybe does a better job either in replenishing glycogen, would then explain the performance enhancement or not.
Yeah.
So that's the recovery aspect of this, right? So the fast food meals, the first one was hot cakes, hash browns, orange juice.
I like where they're going there.
Yeah, and then the next one was hamburger, Coke, and fries.
I like where they're going there too.
Yeah, yeah. So the total 4 hour total was, to put it in kilojoules, was about 5,500 kilojoules. So that's like 1,200 calories, something like that.
Okay.
4.2 kilojoules per kilocalorie. So they got 38 grams of fat, 23 grams of carbs, 26 grams of protein in those two meals.
Okay.
And then, of course, so that was right immediately afterwards, 2 hours afterwards, and then they did the 20-kilometer time trial. So the sports supplement feeding, you're thinking, okay, so they would have used something fine-tuned. No. They matched the macros and the calories.
Okay.
So they used Gatorade and organic peanut butter and some Cliff Shot blocks for the first meal. So it had fat, carbs, and protein to match the first meal.
I like how they put peanut butter in there as a supplement.
Exactly. It's made by Cliff Bar.
Oh, okay.
It's organic, so that's a supplement, right?
Yeah.
There's no creatine in there. Like, that's not. There's no hydrolyzed protein.
No.
There's no EAAs in there. There's no branch. None of those things that referred to in that person's post saying. This is why, this obviously shows that all those supplements are bogus.
Yeah.
Those supplements weren't tested in the study.
And here's the thing, too. I wanted to say something. I feel like you're not necessarily picking on the guy who said.
Oh, no.
You know, but what you are making the point, though, that, that's where my brain went, too. You know, it was like, oh, well, this must be comparing it to, like you said, high-quality supplements.
You would think so. Actually, I think the title was, they should have put this is basically if it fits your macros type of comparison study.
Yeah.
And the second meal, but we'll get back to that point in a second. Let's just say Cytomax, Power Bar Recovery, PBCC, and a Power Bar Energy Chews. Huh. So basically the calories, the fat, carbs, and protein were identical.
Okay.
Sodium was a little bit higher in the fast food, but probably nothing to do about that unless it just added sodium. So literally they basically matched macros and calories.
Yeah.
And they found the same degree of glycogen replenishment, and they found no impact on that 20-kilometer time trial.
Interesting.
Lo and behold.
Yeah.
They did in no way, shape, or form did they try to exploit what the advantages of a sports supplement would be.
Which
would be, let's use hydrolyzed, high glycemic, insulin secreting, glycogen replenishing designer supplements like creatine or hydrolyzed protein or highly branched cyclic dextrins, maybe even a glucose disposal agent like alpha lipoic acid, because there's a million things they could have done.
Yeah,
to try to let's see if we really take the essence of what these sports supplements are supposed to do in this particular context. And this has a great application for people who might be not necessarily cyclists, but people who are like wrestlers,
sure,
who are at a meet and they got to wrestle multiple times a day,
yeah,
or anyone who's got multiple performances over the course of a weekend's competition, and that happens to kids sometimes. So you're not going to give them a lot of fat,
right?
Probably, but that's what you get in fast food. So they call the sports supplement fat. So it actually tells you that, you know, that's like basically in one way, it says if you use organic peanut butter and these power bar energy shoes don't have any fat, but the Power Bar Recovery PBCC, I have to look that up. I think it's a power bar of some sort. It's got a good amount of fat. A lot of those taste so fucking good because they've got a lot of fat in them.
Yeah.
They're just protein laden candy bars.
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much.
So that's the thing, is that it was, first of all, the news story is misleading, as you sensed. The study in and of itself, I think, is poorly designed to test what's going on with supplements. And then if you're reading through the comments, like this, interpreting BS research, our full article costs $25. It's like, no, Google Scholar, you can get it for free, as I did. And then he says, 90 minutes on a treadmill will not fully deplete glycogen stores. Well, it wasn't actually on a treadmill. That's what they said in the news story. It was a cycling exercise. And they show the levels of glycogen immediately afterwards. Hmm. All the data are documented right there in the study. All that is available. So it's all right there. So the point is that this is what I see almost every time I dig in with this sort of thing. And it's kind of it's really a shame.
Yeah.
No, it's not the best study, but it's a kind of a cool one in a certain way. I mean, it'd be interesting to see what the breakdown would be cost wise on the hash cakes, hash brown and orange juice. I mean, it's probably just literally, I'm almost sure that's a McDonald's meal, man.
I would have to think so. I think it's like that big breakfast thing they do, you know?
Yeah. And a hamburger, a medium Coke and a small fries.
Yeah.
It's not very much. And then, but what's a 20 ounce Gatorade with a Kit's organic peanut butter? It looks like it's probably, I don't even know how they, I have to look that up because it's like it's a low fat peanut butter maybe or something.
Oh.
And the Cliff Shot blocks, one block, BLOK. Huh. I don't know. I always wondered about Cliff bars anyway. You know, it's like why have so much fat in them? But they're delicious. If you need food, like you're hiking all day long.
Yes, that's perfect for that.
Yeah, you need the calories just because you're expending like thousands of them constantly moving.
Yeah.
But these guys weren't. They're doing a glycogen dependent cycling bout.
Okay.
A 20 kilometer bout. Let me see what the times were here. Let me figure out what the date are. Put that in a plot.
I was just gonna say, I feel like even though I didn't look into the study, my thought is to always take it with a grain of salt. You know, I never look at that stuff. I never look at that stuff and ever think to myself like, oh man, this has got to be a fact right here. You know, this.
Yeah.
I wonder though, Scott, how do these studies get approved? Like you said, this wasn't really a well-designed study. You could pick that apart and literally just having looked at it. How could that have gotten to the point where like people actually got behind it and they actually took the time to do this? Because I feel like had you had the opportunity to have this conversation with the people who actually conducted the study, they might have rethought about how they did it, you know, but they obviously just didn't have any kind of education. They couldn't have had any kind of education in sports performance, you know?
This is for University of Montana. It's not a bad program. I know someone who was out there for a short period of time.
But how does this happen, though? Like, because it's a terrible supplement. It was a terrible choice of supplements to have picked.
The reason that I said that it was they did a poor job of exploiting what the benefits of sports supplements could be.
Yeah.
Was to make that really apparent because that's how it's being played off in the news.
Mm.
And then I think they had a poor choice of titles. Mm. If they would have put the macronutrient, like that completely changes things.
Sure, sure. The macronutrient from supplements do the same thing as a macronutrient from burgers.
There are many cyclists who, given in that situation, would have chosen those sports supplements in order to optimize recovery in those 4 hours.
Mm.
If they had two meals, they just wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
So that's not what would have happened. So my guess is it does kind of fill – it's an interesting void because there's they've done experiments looking at insulin and lipids, triglycerides, those sorts of things, comparing organic versions versus the fast food versions. If you match the nutrients, they're pretty close. You don't see, like, any, like, huge, like, crazy negative changes. It, like insulin doesn't go sky high, and you don't really see a metabolic adverse effect from a single meal when you make the macros match. I don't know how their fats matched, you know, in terms of saturated and monounsaturated, but the fats were just with two meals in this scenario where you're highly insulin sensitive because they've just reduced glycogen so low.
Yeah,
you really wouldn't expect much, but sometimes you just have to do the date. Like if you constantly assume and no one's actually done the experiment, then you have a big question mark. And so this does fill that question mark. The other part is that, I mean, they I'm looking here, they say no competing interests in access to the data, blah, 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 companies involved with products. So I was thinking maybe that Cliff Bar had been someone that they, you know, were sponsored by. Mm. But no, apparently that's not the case.
Okay.
So it is interesting because you look, there's so many studies that have sort of followed this sort of pattern. So this is a nice one to do. It's just unfortunate because, like, this is the stuff that the news gets a hold of. They didn't even get that. Like, did they do a treadmill run or they did a cycling exercise? It's in the abstract. You don't even have to read the study.
Yeah,
it's in the abstract, which is free to everybody, no matter how deeply you look. And also, these are cyclists. This is not, people are thinking like, oh, recovery sports supplements in your gym bag.
Right.
These guys aren't doing this shit in a gym. I mean, it's a 20-kilometer time trial that they did in the lab. By the way, that was about a 34-minute bout for them. So it's a half an hour. That's basically, they're going as hard as they can for that entire time. They're at lactate threshold.
Right.
Pretty much. They're just going for it. It's a half an hour bout. Hmm. So they could have probably done this a little bit differently, you know, in terms, they could have really depleted glycogen. See what would have happened, but I still wouldn't have expected anything because they matched the macros. They gave the same number of calories, the same number of grams of carbohydrate. Actually, the insulin levels were the same. Hmm. Interestingly enough, how did they? They came up with their own. So you can use what's called a visual analog scale, mm-hmm. which is usually like you can. I think theirs was 150 millimeters. So it's like a scale on a piece of paper, and you say you could use it to like RPE is sometimes is 0 to 10. You can use a visual analog scale and say, what's your rating of perceived exertion? And you just put a little line. Hmm. And there'll be like verbal anchors there. Like 10 would be maximal exertion and 0 would be 0 exertion whatsoever. And then you'd have verbal anchors. They just put a little line there. They came up with their own visual analog scales for things like satisfaction and fullness that I didn't see anywhere. Maybe I missed it, but I didn't see that they validated those scales.
Yeah.
Because you need to know that those are somehow repeatable.
Yeah.
And they actually are measuring different concepts and constructs. Because if people, like, I've done this study before that was privately funded, that was like, you ask people questions and you can tell, like, the fuck are you asking me? Like satisfying and fullness, like, you'd have to, like, really familiarize people to those things.
Yeah.
And they don't have any, they didn't note anywhere that they've got any of that done. So they came up with that. But one thing they did find is that the participants reported being more full during the sports supplement compared to the fast food immediately after the 2-hour feeding.
Hmm.
So that's a good thing in a way. I mean, just for someone who's thinking about what food is going to lead me to overeat.
True. Yeah.
If I eat foods that are sports supplements that are healthier, so to speak, because they come in plastic, you know, bags you can buy off the shelf, right, as opposed from McDonald's. I don't know which is better. They're a little bit fuller, but that was kind of an interesting point, I thought. But I wouldn't put much weight in that because they came up with their own scale. It's like basically like, oh, we're just going to come up with, it's going to be like the exhilaration scale. Like, how exhilarating was that workout for you?
Yeah.
What do you mean exhilarating? Just on a 0, like totally exhilarated and not exhilarating at all. I don't know. Like a 7, it was 7 exhilarating. Like you can, I just made that scale up right now. And right. You could see how that would confuse people.
Sure, sure.
Unless they'd anchored that in some particular way. And right. You have to be very careful with how you present those things. Like the most exhilarating thing you've ever done was like, you ever skydived or, you know, parasailing, or, you know, you climbed Mount Fuji.
Then
you know,
it might not be a seven anymore.
After right. You know? So those are psychometric measurements that I'm certainly not an expert at, but in my experience, they're very, very delicate and labile, meaning they can change all over the place. And you can literally like describe it in one little different way to one person. All of a sudden, like their whole construct goes, fuck, I thought I knew what you meant by exhilarating, and now I'm completely lost. Can you explain that again?
I could see this now. Here's the person that could find this interesting would be not somebody who lifts weights, not somebody who's actively like looking for what you're talking. The things when we think of supplements, I think that our terminology is probably going to be different than your average person. I imagine, you know, there's a park not too far from me here, and up until about this time of year when it starts getting too cold outside, well even for the next couple months, there's a lot of people that go cycling here. It's a long road through the park, and they come out here on the weekends. Average people that are working at a desk, and you know, they're not like an avid cyclist, but they have all the gear and they come out on the weekend and then they ride 10 miles and maybe they get off their bike and they've got a couple options. There's a gas station over here where they could pick up a Gatorade, they could pick up a Cliff Bar, or there's McDonald's next door. Those would be like the people I think that could be. And then in that case, you know, then they could be wondering, well, like maybe the Cliff Bar is a better option. And maybe for them now they're going to see like, well, I guess macros, it's, you know what I mean? Yeah. I guess for them, maybe those would be the people where like real world, who is the study going to benefit if they were to actually break it down? Maybe those people could learn something from it. But
here's the thing though, like in this particular study, they went 90 minutes to deplete glycogen, a 90 minute taxing ride, which is way beyond what most people would do. If they would have gone like 2 hours or so, they probably would have gotten to where they're bonking. So people don't do that. And they put a 4 hour window for recovery for then a maximal 20 kilometer time trial, which fits almost like it doesn't fit that average, you know, recreational cyclist daily profile of what they're doing. They're not like going for broke for an hour and a half as hard as they freaking can. And then spending 4 hours trying to recover so they can go and do a 20-minute all-out bout. So what this sort of says, I mean, literally, in terms of recovery, which you think of as something that's related to your health, you want to recover from exercise because exercise will help you for you, just kind of conceptualizing as the average person, fast food is just as effective as supplements.
Yeah.
And like, okay, in this very specific context, doing things that probably no one who's read this or like 0.01% of people have actually been in this scenario. It's a very contrived one, you know, really, because they create a set of experimental conditions to try to test and compare these two different things. So like if you were thinking like, what would be you could literally, the smarter meal would be go have like a healthy salad with some salmon and, you know, some rice that's, you know, some wonderful rice that you get at like organic rice at a nice restaurant
with
carbs and fat and doesn't have a lot of saturated fat in it per se. And like something that fits in with a generally healthful diet. You can throw some berries and some fruits in there. You can maybe use nuts for the fat. And there's probably nuts in some, I don't know what's in those the Cliff Bars or the Power Bars. But you could literally go in between. You don't have to go with supplements, which people think, oh, the supplements have to be the best because they've been so highly engineered. Well, that's a silly supplement strategy. So there's so many things about this that doesn't really reveal what happened. That would never, no one's going to read that. Like, imagine, like, what do you come up with a title for your Washington Post? Actually, I clicked on the other one. It says, need to recover and work out fast food is just as effective as supplements. For a workout.
Yeah.
That just tells you, like, for strenuous workout, I'm reading the other article that was linked in the first one.
Right.
Supposedly get us to the everyday exercise is regularly reached for energy bars, protein powders, recovery drinks. Thinking that these dietary supplements provide boosts that normal foods do not. Hmm. Your study, however, finds that when it comes to exercise recovery, supplements are no better than fast food. Hmm. So, yeah, that's true in this context.
Right.
Which doesn't fit with everyday exercise. So it's like, it's so misleading. It's so terrible. So the kind of the thing I'm getting, I'll step off my soapbox now, is that I don't trust, like, when it comes to this sort of thing, at least when it comes to anything that I know a little bit about, like the exercise related stuff, yeah. Just don't trust the media, because their primary goal is to sell you stuff.
Sure.
And you know, it's funny to try. I only had to go two steps deep to find the study. Hmm. You know, funny enough, like it said a new study link, and it actually linked another news article. And then I found the actual study. And then I had to go to Google Scholar, and then I found the full study with all the data. But sometimes you can never find the study. Hmm. Sometimes I'll have to literally go, and you can do this. You'll find, like, you know, Dr. John Smith at MIT conducted this study, blah, 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 in his, you know, lab of biotechnology. And then I'll have to go, okay, so I have to go to PubMed or Google Scholar, and I'll find John Smith,
right,
who's doing this kind of research, and I'll have to dig through the things that he's done.
Yeah.
To eventually find the study, because they will never cite the original research. You can't get to the actual data, you know? So
you don't need it, Scott. You've got the newspaper to explain it to you.
To lie to you. Yes, exactly. So there's that, and just watch out, because the comments that were made on that thread, some of them, you know, are very fitting to what you typically would see. There's a lot of times a mismatch between research and, you know, applying that to real life.
Yeah.
As there is here, actually. But that, like, those comments didn't at all fit what actually was done in this study, because they were relying also on the news story. So no one had actually read the study. So you're getting, like, filtered, like, basically misinformation everywhere until you dig into the study itself. Yeah. And then, of course, you have to trust the researchers that they were honest in everything that they put out.
Sure.
So anyway, so Google Scholar is phenomenal. Don't trust the news media, and dig in. Like, I will go, I just, this happens almost every time. The overall, what happens here, and this is the thing to watch for, and I do this, we all do this because we're humans, confirmation bias.
Yeah.
Constantly, that's the first thing, like when you see something and you have an immediate impression based on your past experience, confirmation bias, it can be a lifesaver in certain situations. So it's like, you're walking down a road, and it's at night, and the street lights aren't very bright, and you look down, you see a guy in a trench coat and another guy, and they're kind of like walking, like, you know, they're coming up on you, you know, and they're talking loud. Mm-hmm. And this is the same situation you're in when you got mugged the week before,
right,
in just two blocks away. It makes sense to have a confirmation bias, so you get the fuck out of there. I'm not getting mugged again.
Right.
But those guys could be the nicest guys in the world. You don't know. But so that confirmation bias is a lifesaver in many cases. But here, people, basically what's happening is on that thread, most of the comments that I saw directed towards this particular study were simply confirmation bias.
Hmm.
They hadn't even read the study. It's a weird thing. Like, we do it all the time. Like, you know, so-and-so. You see, the worst is when you see, like, you know, someone committed a crime,
yeah,
and people make all sorts of assumptions based on the person's race, creed, color,
sure,
you know, what his intentions were. And it's like, you could be totally off.
I mean, people do that. I see it all the time. I've seen it in podcasts I've put out where, yeah, you know, somebody has a their opinion, but they didn't even listen to it. You know, I think I put out one show that ended up being kind of controversial, and this is a while back, maybe March, April. And there were people coming on to defend the person I was talking about. We didn't say anything like negative. We just talked about the facts. But because it was about them, I had people coming on and being like, I can't believe that you would say this. You would do all this. And, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And I said, you know, did you even listen to the show? And I had people say, fuck no, I wouldn't listen to that. Well, then your point doesn't have valid.
Alan Aragon on the Swally Trinity, that was a theme that happened too. People just came on blast.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was another one. So yeah, you're totally right, man. Absolutely. So you just have to watch for that. And this was just such an obvious example.
Yeah. You know? People don't want to dig in. Yeah. In fact, you know, I've been doing a lot of research as far as how to create content that people are going to digest. You know, the attention span is so short. That, you know, they say that, like, with YouTube videos, you need to hook them in the first 8 seconds, or the probability of them continuing to watch, the probability of them not clicking on something else goes way, way down. There's a good chance. There's a good chance that a lot of people aren't watching this right now because they didn't want to hang. But we do have our people that will watch, and they are, they're with us now. They're hearing this. They're seeing this. So,
And if anyone finds an example of this, you send it to me, because I'll start collecting. Or if anyone learns, like, you know what, I can start digging in and finding things. Google Scholar is phenomenal.
Yeah.
To find this stuff, it's so much more. God, I mean, here's my. I would much rather hear and be exposed to new and novel opinions, which you get when you dig in, than to hear the same, some often, but not always, but same, the same cans rattling about the things that confirm my biases. I don't learn anything from that. It's like, okay, I know that. Like, heavyweights build muscle. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, I know this. Like, so, you know, it's so much more fun and entertaining, and life's too short to kind of live in the soup of the same ideas, I think.
Sure.
So, anyway.
It was a good topic.
That was my rant, so to speak. My educational rant for the week.
It was a good topic, and it's a good reminder. Guys, let's take a really quick commercial break. We'll come back. We've got some questions. Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends, and they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com, and use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows. Got questions. We've had a few people ask for the link here from the YouTube page to say, hey guys, how can I ask questions? So if you want to do that, the link to this is also in the show notes. We are at the Facebook group for Advices Radio, which is the audio sister site of Think Big Bodybuilding Media. So here we go. We have one from Chris. He says, other than testosterone, because you need a certain amount of it to replace natural production, is there a minimum effective dose for gear? A lot of times I hear you have to run X gear at Y milligrams per week to see results. I believe there's a point of diminishing returns, but shouldn't there be a reasonably linear benefits up until that point? For example, someone said the minimum effective dose of EQ is 400 milligrams a week. So adding 100 milligrams a week would do nothing, or even 50? That doesn't make sense to me.
All right. So there's a number, like, and this would actually be a good, really good question for Dr. Dean St. Mark, who's the, you know, the pharmacologist.
Okay.
You know, that you've had on many times. So EQ is a good example, because boldenone undecyclinate is a very long ester. It basically, God, the half-life is on the order of like 10 or 2 weeks, something like that. It takes quite a while to build up in the system. So you take the typical context where someone would be using maybe just testosterone and they add that in. It's going to take a little while for that to build up.
Yeah.
So that makes a difference. Obviously, if you use like, if someone were to use like testosterone base or testosterone no ester, like that's something you could feel in a half an hour.
Yeah.
Or orals, because the half-life is so short, you feel that immediately. Even small amounts a lot of times. So there's the rate at which it comes in that basically is changing the perception that people have as to whether, and of course there's a dose response for these things. So the dose response is contingent upon the half-life of the drug. which in the case of EQ is going to be a very long one. In the case of something that's that you would inject that has no ester on it, that's just the free molecule, or an oral, it's very short. So that's gonna impact. So like 400 milligrams a week, drop that down. So that's gonna be like, you know, 60, 55 milligrams per day on average, something like that. Well, it's very slow. Oh, I see you like to comment. It's very slow acting. Whereas if you were in sort of some part of that too, the 4 milligrams is also the weight is on the ester too. So let's say it's 50 milligrams per day, something like that. That's not math isn't dead on. You compare to 50 milligrams of D-ball, which you would feel immediately most, right, in most cases, because it's hitting the system in a matter of hours, minutes.
Yeah.
Totally different scenario. So that's part of where that comes from. So he's right in that, yeah, it will be having a pharmacological or physiological effect immediately once it goes in, but it's going to take some time for that to start to occur, which is why people say there needs to be sort of a minimum effective dose. So that, I think, basically that perception for the minimum effective dose is almost my guess is just completely, when people say it's completely related to when they start to feel it, when they've added it in on a cycle or they started a cycle with it, they put it in there. And then, you know, if 16 weeks down the way, 200 milligrams might actually be still having an effect. They just wouldn't notice anything unless they completely dropped it out, for instance,
okay,
especially with EQ. The other thing too is that, a lot of this I'm trying to interpret what people say this is the androgenicity or the extent to which an androgen binds to the androgen receptor is also going to, and the side effects that are brought on from that are also going to have an impact on someone's perception as to whether it's working or not. So, like, it's funny, like, people say EQ increases your hunger, you know, a lot of people don't notice that at all. Some people say high levels of EQ, like, if you go, like, to, like, 800 milligrams or a gram a week, you're going to get insomnia. Some people don't experience that. Some people do.
Yeah.
But it'll take some time for that to happen. But you take something like tranacetate, which binds the androgen receptor much more strongly than boldenone, you're going to feel that at a smaller dose because literally it does have a stronger effect on a milligram basis. So there's something to say there for that too. Absolutely. So every little bit, and here's the other thing, and this is where I would love to see hear Dr. Dean's commentary on this, because, you know, there is some competition, although I've heard people say differently. To my knowledge, there's only one androgen receptor. It's expressed in various tissues, but there's only one gene. It's carried on the X chromosome. So you get it from your mom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you've got androgen receptors in a given tissue, muscle or brain or nerve or wherever it may be. And if you've got X milligrams of one molecule that binds very tightly, and X milligrams, another molecule that doesn't bind as strongly to the androgen receptor, and let's say those milligrams are equal, there's going to be a competition scenario.
Yeah.
And if someone's taking in like a lot of stuff, let's say someone's already at over a gram, and they add in EQ and a gram of, I don't know, let's say they're using like tren and test and like. I don't know, Ment or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, like they're really like binding the fuck. You're going to add in EQ at 200 milligrams. It's not really going to do much.
Yeah.
Because it's being so heavily outcompeted. So the minimum effective dose for something to have an effect is dependent upon its half-life and how tightly it binds the androgen receptor, plus the person's perception of all the side effects that might come along with that, their sensitivity to those things,
yeah,
and the context of the other antigens that are in the system at the same time, potentially competing. So there could be, and it could be overlapping side effects. Like some people, like let's say someone's using Ment or what have you, and tren, and they get the same side effects from both. You know, they might not feel anything when they add tren on top of ment, because the ment's already basically giving them all the perceptions of being on an androgen of that kind. You know, or maybe, like, let's say it's nandrolone and tren, 219 NORs, and they get Decadic from both tren and nandrolone. Well, they, if you add, you know, they're not going to, and that's the main thing that they notice, it's not going to matter. They're not going to get an increase, even more Decadic from using more nandrolone if they already get it from tren, which doesn't happen to everyone, which is very interesting too. So, so there's a bunch of things that go into that, but yeah, once it's in there, it's not doing nothing. It's just that you can't tell what it's doing, because it may be basically overcrowded by all the other things that are going on in the current cycle.
That makes sense. That makes sense to me. You know, minimum effective dose. I guess you're saying too, then it's going to vary on those factors. One of the factors I think that was interesting is that you said how you perceive side effects. That's an interesting one. You know, if you don't notice that stuff, then you might think that there's been something I think that I've noticed more and more, that people are using lower and lower doses, which I think is great, but I do think there is a minimum dose that's like, if I'm gonna do this, it's you know, I want to go to at least, you know, X amount of milligrams, something like that, to make a difference. So my brain's just kind of turning. You got me thinking about a few different things, and I made a couple notes too to talk about with Dr. Dean. I plan on trying to get him back on pretty soon, so that'd be worthwhile.
I'd love to be on with that, just to like kind of pick at his brain. So there's the interesting thing there. I mean, if you think about it, you know, 100 milligrams testosterone produced per week is, you know, that's HRT. 7 to 10 milligrams per day, something like that. Those are the numbers that you hear in terms of testosterone production.
Okay.
So it would make sense, and maybe Dr. Dean could, you know, I have to go and look what, see what like kind of like the KM is, like look at some of the binding profiles, but that's about where the system is set up to have sensitivity to elevations or decreases in testosterone. It's not very much. 100 milligrams, nothing. Obviously, you can use 500 milligrams or 600, like in the Bosin study, the classic study, and get an effect. So you're like, there's a wide range that you can go to, and it's pretty friggin' wide. So the interesting thing is, like, if you have someone who's on like 800 milligrams, and if you add 200 milligrams of EQ, well, that's 200 milligrams of EQ. Let's say there's a long ester on there, but like, let's say that's 120 milligrams of boldenone.
Yeah.
Milligram per milligram, just that boldenone is more milligrams than your body would normally be producing in terms of testosterone. That's a higher number of milligrams of an androgen than your body normally produces endogenously on its own. Hmm. So you would think, well, it's got to be doing something, but not in that context.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's like, so like normally you like I look around here and like, well, there's one person in my living room and 2.5 dogs kind of hanging outside. Yeah. So you know, if we go and we add, like, if two people come in here,
yeah,
let's just triple the number of people. That completely changes the dynamic in my living room.
Yeah.
People were talking to one another. Where are we going to sit? Like, can I bring you a drink? Like, everything totally different.
Yeah.
So what happens then if we, you know, we go up tenfold?
Say you had 10 people in there and then you brought two more in.
Exactly. So we got 10 people. Like, that's like 1,000 milligrams a week, which is where a lot of people are.
Yeah.
No big deal. And then, so here's the thing. This is actually not a bad analogy. So, like, let's say tren or something that binds to an androgen receptor or something that's fast acting is kind of like a boisterous person. If they bind tightly and they're fast acting, is they move around a lot. They're hyperactive. So EQ is like, it's not a really strong androgen, and it's slow acting. So so you've got a room and you've got all these like loud, boisterous, like, let's say it's an Italian family or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And they're, and Italian and Irish people, and they're like running around, they're being boisterous and crazy. And then you bring in, like, you know, two kind of slow acting, you know, people who aren't very loud, and they're kind of like, they're sort of reclusive.
Librarians. Yeah.
Like, yeah, you would there. You wouldn't even know they're there.
Yeah.
So you do have two more people in the room.
Yeah.
And they may eat, like, if you look at what happened to the food that you set out, they may eat just as much food. They may be doing things.
Yeah.
And they may be having some impact. They may, one of them may plug up your bathroom when they use the toilet, or things could happen, but you wouldn't even necessarily know from them, because they don't say anything about it. Like, they leave and like, what happened to the toilet? And like, well, they were too embarrassed to tell you, you know, so you figure it out. So you didn't even know that it was the EQ that had that effect, because EQ is sort of the quiet, you know, shy person, the shy energy that has an effect, but it's unbeknownst to you. Yeah. There's no loud side effects. They're not being, you know, like they're not slamming beer mugs together or
especially
whatever.
Especially 200 milligrams, two people versus, you know, in a crowded room. Versus if you were to bring in 10 librarians, then you might notice a difference. They're there, right?
Right. Like, those bad librarians hotter than the others. Like, wow, that's I'm paying attention to that librarian.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. But still, it'd be 10 librarians. So you still have the same room of librarians be talking about, like, you know, index card systems and, you know,
right.
And good old days of microfiche and microfilm. God, I miss them, you know, and these kids these days, they don't know how to be quiet in the library. Like, you have the same conversation. So there's nothing different and new about it that you would notice. Mm. So here's the thing. So this is actually, we can just keep going with this analogy. Let's say someone's at whatever, 500 milligrams of test, and they're going to add in EQ.
Yeah.
And so the test is, you know, they can definitely tell a difference. So sex drive's pretty high. EQ isn't renowned to have that effect. 200 milligrams probably wouldn't have that effect on appetite if we're going to. So you got five relatively active social people in your room, and then just two librarians kind of walk in really, really slowly. Mm-hmm. And they don't really mingle a whole lot. Well, if you bring in four of them, 400 milligrams on top of 500, well, now you've almost got an even Steven, pardon the almost pun there, even Stevenson, even Steven mix of test and EQ in this case.
Yeah.
So now the EQ's effect is going to be, because it's at a larger relative dose, everything itself is going on. So you could take that analogy and basically describe a lot of those pharmacological parameters that explain, at least from my perspective, why people think there's a minimum effective dose for different compounds, because of how tightly they bind the androgen receptor, their half-lives, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm.
So,
We could keep running with that. I like that. And yeah. I feel like if we had the technology to make, you know, you can like click a link on Facebook to do like a poll. We could make one like to find out which steroid are you. You know, when you come into a room, do you tend to be quiet or do you tend to be loud? You know,
you are
trembolone acetate.
Right. You're Anadrol. You are an asshole all the time, every fucking day.
Yes.
Yeah, that's funny.
All right, I'll go down to the next question here. This is from Keenan. He says, "What is the physiological explanation for muscle maturity? Does this represent some kind of histological changes? Does long-term lifting lead to proportionately less subcutaneous fat / water at similar body fats? Is it denser myofibers? Something else entirely?" It's a good question. I feel like we've all taken that for granted. I've seen it, Scott, where I am not heavier than I was a couple years ago. Like, in fact, I'm lighter, but looking at the pictures, my quality is so much better. I would rather be this weight now than 10 pounds heavier and have the muscle quality look the way it does.
Yeah. So there's a couple things. One thing, actually, you kind of misread what is almost the end question there. Is it denser myofibrils?
Fibrils? I don't know.
That's what he wrote. Yeah, exactly. So here's the thing. That's why I bring it up in part.
Yeah.
People will say, like, you could see every fiber in his muscle.
Yeah, yeah.
No. Muscle fibers, the big ones are going to be like 100 microns or a tenth of a millimeter across.
Mm.
The big ones. That's not visible with the human eye. That's not what you're seeing when you see striations like on Kai Green's quads or Jay Cutler's good quad that he always would show. That's the shape of the epimysium, the fascia that covers the whole muscle. And those are more than likely fascicles of muscle. So fibers will be bundled together in fascicles, mm-hmm. hundreds and hundreds of fibers and fascicles. And that will sometimes give that surface shape that you see as striations, which can go away if someone's done a bunch of injections. Like people will lose the possibility of having glute striations if they get lean enough because they've got so much scar tissue in their glutes.
Jordan Peters brought that up when he was on It's Just Bodybuilding, talking about natural guys in their shoulders versus enhanced guys. That they,
right.
you know, natural guys can get a lot crisper shoulders in general than after, you know, you've shot them up for years and years.
Exactly. So on the scale, what you're not seeing individual fibers. You're seeing probably fascicles, or just the way that it may not even be that. It may just be the way that the fascia is shaped. Fibers are an individual, a myofiber or a muscle fiber is an individual cell, and myofibrils are a collection of actin and myosin, sort of like the way I sort of think of it is if a muscle cell, this is why I was explaining it in my A&P classes, so a muscle cell is like a cylindrical can that you could put like dry spaghetti in, and you pull those dried spaghetti, each piece of spaghetti, that would be a myofibril. And each can would be a fiber. And if you had like a whole like pallet of cans that was sort of in a circular formation, that would be a fascicle. And you'd have multiple pallets in a room that would be a given muscle. And those could be oriented in all sorts of different directions. They could be pinnated like the skeleton, like in your chest at different angles.
Yeah.
So you get different angles to pull. You've got multi-pinnate muscles sometimes, like the rectus femoris. If you ever look really close at a really well-developed rectus femoris, you'll see a central tendon, and you'll see fibers coming in on both sides. That's a bipennant muscle. It's pretty cool. That looks really sweet on someone who's got that well-developed. Mine, you can see mine when I'll try to take a picture when I'm lean. You can see it right now. So anyway, you're not seeing the fibers. What does happen is a matter of even training, is that you do get at a given body fat percentage, you do end up having a thinner subcutaneous fat layer as people age.
Okay, and I can see that.
Yeah, you can see this. Like if you look at, for instance, the easiest one to find that I know of is the Dernan and Walmersley, which is the Jackson and Pollock is a skinfold equation that most people use. And sometimes you'll see the Dernan and Walmersley table, or just an equation both. And the table shows you the skinfold total for their standardized sites for men and women. And then age. So if you look at someone who has a skin fold total of 15 at age 20, and someone has a skin fold total of 15 at age 50, that person at age 50 actually has higher body fat when they test them underwater weighing in this case. So there's more, they store less of their body fat subcutaneously.
I can see that.
So they could be like, I don't know, 15 is pretty lean. Let's say it's 25, but if they're 45 years old and they've got 25 millimeters in their, I think it's 4 skin folds, they might be 15%. Whereas if they've got 25 and they're 20, they might be 11%.
I'll be damned.
Yeah. So you can see that like there, and it's been documented in studies, but that's kind of easy. It's like, wow, that's crazy. Like same skin folds, older you get, the fatter you are. But if you're at 10% when you're 20 versus 45, the 45-year-old is going to have a smaller skin fold. They're going to have thinner skin. That, I think, is a big part of this muscle maturity phenomenon. It's literally the skin fold, the subcutaneous layer gets thinner at any given level of body fat as we age. That's just aging phenomenon. So on top of that, like I think one thing that and I've never seen this documented, but this has been my I've noticed this, is that the longer you can get more vascularity, which gives that graininess. That's what I think is really what gives a lot of the graininess look. And I actually almost, it felt like so like narcissistic almost to post this, but it was sort of an anatomical thing. I know you've seen, anyone who's been really, really lean, you've seen this, or if someone is like really lean, they can go check this out, especially if they're pretty vascular. And you'll see that you've got, there are veins that are in the skin. And then there are also veins that are travel along the fascia of the muscle. So like on my quads, I'll try to like, I could have done it today. Next time I train legs, which will probably be a couple days from now.
Okay.
When they're all pumped up and you're vascular, you can take the skin and slide it back and forth, and you can see that the veins in the skin move as you move the skin.
Yeah.
And the veins that are connected to the fascia, not the skin, they stay in place. So you've got two layers of veins. I didn't have that, I don't think, 15 years ago, or I never got, I mean, I got lean when I was on, I just didn't have that. So the vascularity that comes, I think, more slowly over the course of time for someone who keeps on training, gives a different look. It gives that hardness. It gives that graininess. It gives that part of what is that essential sort of that muscle maturity.
Do you,
and probably, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, and I didn't mean to cut you off, but do veins, will veins get thicker and ropier with time? And my thought is this is, and I'm coming at this just from like bro science guess here, but you know, if you're growing muscle, if you're pumping a lot of blood into that muscle, are those veins going to increase in size? Could you increase, will you increase like your vascular network over time? Will it grow?
There's genetics, obviously. Like Jay Cutler, awesome separate. I mean, he's Mr. Olympia, one of the greatest bodybuilders by far, but not known for his vascularity. He wasn't a really, really vascular dude.
Right.
But the thing, and I haven't seen this study. We know, of course, like you look at capillaries, capillary density goes up with endurance training.
Okay.
Capillaries are there to deliver oxygen and then pull away all the metabolites that accumulate, CO2 and lactic acid, what have you. So, like if you do, like if they've done resistance training studies where they, you compare like heavy lifting, like powerlifter style lifting with a more kind of typical bodybuilder routine, higher reps, more sets. And you'll get, actually a lot of times with like the heavy lifting stuff in the earlier studies, you'd actually get a dilution of mitochondria, meaning that the muscle got bigger, but you didn't gain any mitochondria, because you didn't have much of an aerobic stress. There's not a whole lot of metabolite accumulation there to deal with. You don't need to engage that aerobic system very much. And the capillaries, you'll even dilute them. So let's say you have like you may have like three capillaries per fiber. So that's one way they do it. So you take out a muscle biopsy, you have all these fibers, and you have capillaries in between them.
Yeah.
And there's really a capillary network, but when you look at it in cross section, it just kind of counts the capillaries. So you may still end up with three capillaries per fiber, because there's nothing stressing the muscle to get more capillaries. Blood flow, delivery, and getting rid of waste products isn't really a big deal when you're training with lower reps like that. You're not getting an awesome pump. You're not stressing the system in that way. So you got three capillaries per fiber, but now your fibers, you know, got, let's say, 50% bigger. So what you've actually done is you've diluted the actual capillary density in terms of cross-sectional area. More muscle, same number of capillaries, so the relative number of capillaries per muscle unit muscle area is less. Makes sense?
I think so, yeah.
But if you have someone who does bodybuilding training, you can get more capillaries. You can get more mitochondria, or at least the mitochondrial density will stay in check with in sync with the increase in fiber size, because you're stressing that system. You're getting a pump all the time. You have to get rid of all that blood. So what also stresses blood, blood flow, is heat. And I've kind of noticed this. I paid attention, like a lot of the old school guys, like Rich Gaspari was a perfect example. Those guys would train covered up a lot of the times.
Mm-hmm.
You know that picture of Rich Gaspari, that badass black and white one, that's always black and white at least, where he's doing a most muscular and the veins are just fucking all over the place.
I do. Yep.
Yeah. Branch Warren trains in fucking Texas heat.
Okay.
With no air conditioning. And he trains really fucking hard, and they just keep going, and it's just absolute brutality. I mean, there's obviously, you can criticize his form and everything else. I'm not trying to say like that's how everyone should train, but the nature of and the exertion level and the heat that he's putting himself through is the kind where you're bringing blood through, and to dissipate heat, one of the main ways, in order to dissipate heat, you have to get it to the surface of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So you have increased vascularity, increased blood flow. At the surface, and when you the heat that comes into the blood is lost when you have sweat that evaporates.
Sure.
Because the phase change, the sweat that's water evaporates into a vapor and it goes away, and there's a certain amount of heat that is used up in doing that. So the heat is brought to the skin surface, and you have sweat that evaporates to dissipate heat. And that's the really the main way for dissipating heat if things are going all right. If you like sweat and the sweat's not evaporating, and it's just dripping on the floor, you're just losing fluid.
Yeah.
Because you're not losing heat through that evaporative process. So lots of blood flow, the ability to get that hot blood out of the muscle to get rid of the lactic acid and to get that the vascular and the skin surface is because of a heat overload, because you want to get the heat out and you want to get the surface so you can evaporate that heat, basically. And the other thing, there's more to, I thought about this in a little bit detail. I didn't even know this question was on there. I just have had this in my head because I've been asked this a few times. Is if you're training really fucking hard,
yeah,
with big weights, big movements, going for it, your blood pressure goes up.
Mm.
So you want to like make your veins go out, you do a Valsalva and you go, and the veins get bigger. So that's a volume overload on the veins. So you've got these veins that are being told, we need to carry lots of blood, we need to have a large capacity, and they're being distended on a repeated basis because of the Valsalva and the increase in blood pressure that you have, which extends the veins. So there's a mechanical and a thermal stress that combines under the, you know, sort of the guise of the physiological stress that's brought on by training hard with higher volume in the heat, yeah, that comes. And then so your guy's been doing that for 20, 30 years. Like, I mean, it's kind of cool today, but like there have been times when I've just gone through like months where I just train in my back of my back porch.
Yeah.
It's fucking hot as shit. Lower, I have a fan and that was it, you know, nothing. And those are brutal. Like it takes away your ability to train hard. But I go into like a regular gym and like there's no thermal stress at all, no matter what I do compared to that.
Because you're used to training out back.
Yeah, that's intense. And I go out and I work outside a lot too. Like, you know, I spend hours outside doing stuff. So I don't, the heat doesn't bother me. Actually, I don't even like to be cold in the gym. A lot of people are like that. But so take someone who's been training hard with high blood pressures. Maybe they're training covered up or they train just so hard there's a lot of heat stress. All those other things combined for years. Plus their skin is getting thin. And maybe like you, they're starting to dial in their diet even better. Mm-hmm. And you're getting more developed because you've learned how to train. You know, like the separation in your quads, really, I've mentioned this before in the show, is it's kind of a function of having a well-developed rectus femoris that divides the medialis and the lateralis on the quad. Like if that muscle is weak, then you kind of like you don't see it. But if you look for someone with a really deep separation in their quads, they're going to have a medialis on one side, a lateralis on the other, and this rectus femoris. And that it's that separate, it's that deep crevice between the two muscles because they're round and fully developed that gives you separation. So having trained for all those things combined, and that's I think what happens when someone's got good muscle maturity. If some of it's just an aging phenomenon, and then just fucking years of hard training and dialing shit in, and the vascularity effect too.
Well, that makes sense. Hey, speaking of physiques, you look, is it just me? Is it just the angle here today? You look full.
I do? Oh, you do. I don't know. I trained this morning already.
Okay.
So maybe that's it.
Do you, have you increased your food at all around training, or have you upped it recently, like yesterday or anything like that, or no? Maybe it's just me.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's funny. Yeah. My weight's coming back up now. Like, okay. But I'm only like, I'm just like 3 or 4 pounds up, like in the last, like literally I'm like 2.5 pounds up in the last week, last 2 weeks. Okay. It's like,
that's it.
There's nothing. And I haven't eaten hardly anything today. I'm going to go have sushi after this.
Ooh, nice.
But I knew if I had a big post-workout meal, I'd be like, oh, let's fucking end this shit.
Fall asleep.
So, yeah. So I'm going to go have an all-you-can-eat sushi.
That sounds good, man. I think we're about ready to wrap this thing up then. We're well in over an hour here. So I think you could probably go grab your sushi meal sooner than later then, it sounds like.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah. Thanks for the compliment too. You know, it's weird. Who knows?
Tank top. You wore one last week. I only see you every couple of weeks. So, you know, I get that perception of, you know, I've watched you dieting now for a while. You've been staying fairly lean. Well, not fairly. You've been staying very lean. And so I just noticed it. Sometimes it just jumps out at you and you go, huh, Dr. Scott's looking fuller today.
I had the glycerol in my workout meal. Remember I talked about the glycerol?
Absolutely, yeah, I did.
I had a scoop of protein.
Yeah.
And then some glycerol. I mean, we're talking like I'm less than 500 calories for the day so far.
Wow. Okay.
I had a protein shake after I came back, but the glycerol people haven't tried that. It's something I keep on seeing people putting monoglycerol stearate in their drinks.
Okay.
The powdered form of glycerol.
Yeah.
I'm going to actually go and do the math on and see how much that actually costs if you can buy that by itself.
What is that? Monoglyceride sterols?
It's a monoglyceride. So it's monoglycerol stearate. So stearic acid is a fatty acid.
Okay.
And if you have glycerol, if you have tristearyl glycerol, mm-hmm. that's a triglyceride. That's a fat.
Mm-hmm.
That's glycerol with three stearic acid molecules connected to it. Stearyl is an acyl, which is a fatty acid molecule. So that's basically just a fat. So monoglycerol stearate or mono, I've seen it done different ways. It's basically just glycerol with one fatty acid connected to it.
Okay.
So the glycerol is just got three carbons, and stearate has like, I want to say 16 or 14, 18. I can't remember.
Huh.
I can't remember the number of carbons, but it's a pretty fucking big molecule. So a large percentage of that powdered form of glycerol is fatty acid. Most of it's fat, calorically speaking. You're not getting very much glycerol on a gram per gram basis.
Okay.
So you can buy the glycerol, because people have been asking me about this. I think we mentioned this on the last show.
Episode. We did, yeah.
I got a bunch of messages like, where can I get that shit? Is this the right one on Amazon?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's so much cheaper to just buy glycerin, you know, or glycerol, same thing.
Let's do this. We'll make sure we get the something that's good, a good product. I'll put a link in the description here on the YouTube page. So anybody who did want to check it out could find. So you're just saying just straight glycerol would be your suggestion still, or you're not sure, or?
Well, I mean, if you do what I do and you make your own shakes and you just buy the raw ingredients to save money, then
if you want to, then
that's the cheapest way to get glycerol.
Cheapest. Okay.
And it tastes sweet and you can use as much as you want and not work. I mean, literally, I'll look it up right now. Hold on here. Let's just look this up for somebody. I buy it by the gallon, I think. It's glycerin on Amazon.
Okay.
And yeah, Froggy's Fog Vegetable Glycerin Kosher, USP 99.7 pure.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1 gallon. It costs $25.
$25 for a gallon. That'll last you a long time.
It's going for like a year on it, I think.
Damn.
Something like that, yeah. You can buy a half gallon. You can buy a 5 gallon pail. I have not done that, but it's food grade.
Yeah.
So it's supposed to be eaten, you know?
Yeah.
I'll do the math. I won't waste people's time while I do the math, but the monoglycerol stearate is just like, I don't know how much that costs. But
it's people expensive.
You're putting like 3 grams in there.
Okay.
You put 3 grams of that, you're probably getting less than a gram of glycerol.
No, but what is this? Is this like a bodybuilding product that's being sold?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's a pump product. It's a pump product. Yeah. Like people are, I see it all the time. It's listed in, and you do get, there are some data showing that a very small amount of that will increase muscle hydration. I've seen those data, at least an abstract that was published somewhere.
Okay.
By reputable scientists. So it can have an effect at very small amounts, and people notice it.
Okay.
But if you're buying it that way, and like let's say you have to have a powder.
Yeah.
You know, there's advantages to having a powder using small amounts, but it just makes sense to me. Like if you're looking for the glycerol, and you know you want to buy a gallon that you'll be using until 2029.
Yeah.
You know, then why not just buy it on Amazon for $25?
Oh, there's some advice for you guys. All right, let's get out of here for another episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. As I mentioned before, check out byobbcoach.com to pick up Scott's book. Get the hardcover from Barnes & Noble, Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach, or Amazon. Check out our sponsor, truenutrition.com. You can use our code ADVICES for additional savings. There it is.
It's right side up this time.
All right, guys, we will see you next time. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome, brother. Likewise.